go and get started. Okay, we're shifting gears. We're talking about summary judgment. We've been talking about ways to dismiss a complaint, dismiss an action as we go through. So let's just go ahead and get into it. What is summary judgment? We're going to spend this week talking about it. Here's a good true-false question to get you warmed up today. All right, so which of the following is false? A, summary judgment is granted by the judge, not the jury. B, it may be filed at any time until 30 days after the close of discovery. C, both plaintiffs and defendants may move for summary judgment. Or D, a party must move for summary judgment on the entire case. Which of the following is false? Okay, go ahead and start to click in now if you haven't already. Please click in if you haven't already. Okay, which one of these is false about summary judgment? Okay, good. That's the correct answer. Yay! We're starting off good today. All right, so then why do we call this summary judgment? If we were to define it, each word in summary judgment actually has a meaning within the context of litigation. All right, so how would you define summary judgment, Ms. Askins? Yeah, like why? How would you define summary judgment using the word summary and judgment? What do we mean by those words? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, is it so, because that's we talked about D, that a party must move for summary judgment on the entire case and said that's false. So does it have to be a judgment on everything that's been presented thus far? No, not actually. In fact, you can actually you can move for it just on a claim or just on a defense. So we might put more in the case. So it's not on everything. It's not even on everything that we've discussed thus far. It's on some issue, whether it be a claim or defense, that we believe we can meet the standard for it. So that's why that last one is false. Because what you're telling me, even if you believe like these things are material, would suggest that you have to move forward on everything in the case, and we don't have to. All right, so let's take it then piece by piece. What does judgment mean? Yeah, ruling. And so that's why the A is true. It's a judicial thing. It's a judgment. And we get judgments at the conclusion of a case, even from the jury, but they refer to it here as we're getting it. We haven't gone to the jury. Okay? In summary judgment, are we even really in trial? Generally, no. The only thing we know about when you can file it is true as B, that it must be filed, or maybe filed at any time until 30 days after the close of discovery. So it's something that happens earlier. Generally, it happens somewhere in the course of discovery. Because you're actually looking at what are they going to prove at trial. And say, well, we just don't need that. We don't need to get to trial because we can just rule on what we've seen. We don't need the jury to come in. Which kind of brings us to the next point about being summary. This is a tricky part of summary judgment. What does summary refer to then? Okay. What do you mean by that? Okay, except it's not everything they put together. That would be D again. So it's not the everything. Summary refers to something else. It is what they put together, but it's not everything they put together. Summary means we're not going to a different group than we normally go to. We normally get judgments from or get our ultimate decision on the questions of was the light red, was the light green? The jury. So summary is referring to we're not going to that. And so what do they mean by we're doing something in a summary manner? It means we're looking at the paper evidence as opposed to the live trial evidence. We're looking at the paper evidence as opposed to the live trial evidence. And so things like you get in discovery, like your deposition, get translated into the transcript of the deposition. And you can give the court the transcript and say, this is what this person's going to testify to. You can read their statements. We don't need the jury to listen to them, because even if we consider everything that comes out of their mouth as being the truth, I still win. Okay, that's what we're talking about. So summary, we're on a paper record. We're not at live trial. It's generally before trial for that reason. There's going to be different ways to take a case while we're in the middle of trial that you'll refer to, we're going to get to next week. And judgment meaning the judge gives it to us. So the judge gives us the judgment on a paper record. Okay? Good. I know that one's really tricky. The reason I kept quibbling with the entire record is you're going to, in discovery, kind of be moving around between claims and defenses. Think about our case. Let's say you depose a witness who saw what happened. You might ask them questions about what happened right before the event. You might, like, what were they doing? How did they see it? You might say, what was Reckless doing? And then eventually you're going to say, this person has key evidence on whether or not he was having a heart attack. He's going to say, he was just hanging out, he was waving at someone on the side of the road, looked fine, smacked into her, and then started acting like he was in shock. All right? So there might be a lot of evidence that that person might otherwise tell us about that we could use at trial for a bunch of different things, our claim in general, but we may say, let's move for summary judgment on the only defense he's presented, that it's not valid, that even his own witness says he was operating in a manner that suggests he was totally healthy. Okay? So that's why it's not about, like, everything. We would just then excerpt out the deposition and say, look here, that's going to be what's going to grant a summary judgment. So we'll see that as we go along. But that's the basic of what we're trying to do. We're in discovery. We found out what's going to be proved at trial. We're going to say, look at it. Give me judgment on this paper record. All right. Why do we allow these things? Why do we have it? Well, it makes things much more efficient. If we're don't really need a jury to come in, it makes more sense to allow the judge to give you the judgment. We don't really need the jury. All right. Keep that in mind, because we're going to compare it to the things we've already learned and then focus on the standard, which I think really reflects what summary judgment's trying to do. All right. So the other things we've learned about 12b-6, and I asked this in your worksheet, you know, compare what you know about summary judgment with what we saw in 12b-6. I'll tell you, the biggest things between all these kinds of motions, and the next one that's after summary judgment is next week, are different based on the record that the court is looking to when they grant you the motion and the judgment, and the timing, at what point in the trial we use it. So remember 12b-6, failure to state a claim. What did the court look at when we had a 12b-6? The pleadings. Right? Remember, we said, look at their complaint, they haven't stated a claim. And the rule even told us, if they start attaching evidence outside of just looking at the complaint, we should really treat it as a, remember, motion for summary judgment, right? Okay, so 12b-6, what is it? Just the pleadings. Anytime you even bring anything else in on it, it turns into one of what we're going to talk about today, a summary judgment motion. So big difference, summary judgment motion, we're actually looking at evidence, you know, not at trial kind of evidence like it's been admitted, but what would be admitted at trial. It's something that has to be eventually admissible. You can't even say, well, I can't admit it at court, but you should look at it. Everything has to translate into what would be admissible eventually. All right. Timing is the other issue. Summary judgment is later. Remember, 12b-6 was on the pleading, so summary judgment typically is in discovery. Okay. It's one of the most used motions right now, although we're in an era where 12b-6, because of TWCBA, is getting a lot more traction to it. But up until then, summary judgment was pretty much where cases died. It's very rare for cases to go past summary judgment. Why? Either you win your summary judgment motion and you get a judgment, or you lose your summary judgment motion and you have a whole lot more incentive to settle, because trial becomes expensive. All right. Very few cases actually in our system of litigation in the United States actually make it to trial. So despite everything you see on TV and everything people tell you about the fun cases they've ever done, those are the small things. Most things are up at summary judgment. Right? That's why our course, we're almost at the end of the semester, and you're like, we haven't gotten to juries. That's because you almost never will. We'll get to it at the end. It's kind of proportionate to what you actually do in practice. And then we have a class in trial ad, which talks about what you do in front of a jury. But the reality is that's very, very, very small amounts of what you do. Even if you're a litigator, and all you do is litigate, you pretty much see summary judgment, and then the case is bye-bye. All right? Okay. So, if you get past it, we will have one other one, which we're going to talk about next week, and that one comes in the middle of the trial. Okay? All right, so let's look at the standard for summary judgment. If you're looking at cases, the standard used to be in 56C, and as I noted in my worksheet, which I have to tell you, this is my least favorite amendment of all the things they've done. I think they messed up Rule 56, because it used to have a section of process, and now the new 56C just kind of lumps it all together and lets you sort it out, which, hey, as a rule person, is not the most effective way to write a rule. So I think they make it a little bit difficult. But the standard is basically the same. It's just in a different place. And so it's that the court shall grant summary judgment if the movement shows that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact. It used to be no genuine issue. So sometimes I'll still say it. I apologize. It's just a forced habit. And the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Let's talk about each of these aspects. The first, that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact. And second, that the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. What's the purpose of each one? Why would you have the first one, that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact? If we think about what summary judgment is, Ms. Askin, since we're talking about what summary judgment actually is, why would you have this part of your standard, that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact? Exactly right. If there's a dispute, you generally want to use it for the jury, so you shouldn't, as the judge, be taking it away from the jury. Summary judgment is really only allowed because we don't need the jury. And so this is sort of telling us, when don't we need it? When there's no factual disputes to resolve. And we'll take out, we'll take one and piece it. There's two elements to it in just a little bit. But let's look at the second part, that the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. What does that mean? What's the purpose for that? Okay, so it might be based on statute, or it might be based on common law. But what are we saying about that law? That when we look at it, it says what? What do they mean by the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
That there would be no other verdict that could be reached by another person.
Okay, that's pretty much one, that there's no other way you can look at the dispute, because that's the reasonable person discussion is about the jury, and so that's going to be one. The second one is we look at the law and say, under it, if we have shown this, it means that you, movement, should what? That's right. That's exactly what it means. It means that on the merits, you win. And so this is a merits-based decision. It's a merits-based decision. Well, the first part is we don't need a jury to resolve any facts. The second part is the law says on these undisputed facts, you win. Because we can have no dispute, but that doesn't necessarily mean you win. So there's two pieces. All right. We're going to talk about both. But there's two pieces. One, we don't need the jury to resolve any facts. No disputes that they need to resolve. And secondly, on these undisputed facts, you actually win under the law. All right. So let's try and figure out the difference between one and two by looking at the hypos from the worksheet a little bit. All right. You're going to click one or click two as far as which part of the standard you think this situation fits under. The witnesses disagree about whether reckless negligently drove into Parsons or whether Parsons was not watching as she was rollerblading, causing the accident. Parsons moves for summary judgment. Why deny Parsons' motion? Is it because there's disputed issues of fact that are material? Or two, because she won't be entitled to judgment as a matter of law? Which part of the standard would you say we should deny the motion for? What part of the standard would you deny the motion for? Which part would you deny the motion for?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Good. This one is a question of a dispute of facts. If you look at it, and we made it kind of simplistic initially so you could see it, it's really about, you know, who do you believe? And when it's a question of who do you believe, we need the jury to come in and tell us, well, we need this person to testify before us. And we'll look at their credibility and their demeanor and say who had the better vantage point, who's the more reasonable observant, and conclude on the facts which way it really happened. That's why we use trials, because oftentimes people have differing accounts of the same event. So we say to the jury, which one seems more believable? All right. So then, if that one was one, guess what this one is? It's a number two problem. I know. That's tricky.
All right. Carson sues Reckless for saying, he was looking too happy after the accident. All the witnesses agree they looked happy, and Reckless admits that he looked happy after the accident. So we got no disputed facts. He looks happy.
All right. But are you entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
Is it unlawful to be happy after you hit somebody? I would invite it, but it's not unlawful. It's not against the law. There's no judgment you get from looking happy, right? Because you can still be non-negligent and happy all the time, you know? So in general, what are you looking for? This one's kind of, you know, extreme to a point to show the differences between the two. Typically what you see here is when there's some defect in the legal argument. So where do you find judgment as a matter of law? Is that somewhere in the rules where you're going to see a rule that says these are the reasons why you get judgment as a matter of law under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? Where would you find that? Yeah.
Look to the actual claim and elements of the
claim. Uh-huh. So it's the substantive law. So would that mean we might have to look to a statute?
And regs, any of the substantive law that embody that claim or that defense. And you look to its elements and say, have we shown all of those? All right? Have we shown all of those? It's the substantive law.
All right, and since the substantive law doesn't have a claim for this just yet, you won't get relief. All right, so just to bring it to our case, when is a plaintiff entitled to judgment as a matter of law, for instance, in negligence? And I know you're all learning this now. So when would you, as a plaintiff, be entitled to judgment as a matter of law for negligence? If you show duty, breach, cause, and damages by a preponderance of the evidence, or if you show duty or breach or cause or damages by a preponderance of the evidence? Which one? When is a plaintiff entitled to judgment as a matter of law? When's a plaintiff entitled to judgment as a matter of law? Go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Okay, good. Let's flip it, though. What about a defendant? When is a defendant entitled to judgment as a matter of law? If you were to say, since you're going faster than I can go, give me a second here. When is a defendant entitled to judgment as a matter of law? All right. Okay, good. Most of you have that one right. It's the opposite, because a defendant can win simply by defeating any single element of the plaintiff's claim. So in general, who is summary judgment easier to meet as far as the second half of the standard? Who is it typically an easier burden for? Yeah. Okay. So that's typically why you see the defendant using this type of emotion more than the plaintiff's. I'll tell you, though, in practice, I saw lots and lots of cross motions for summary judgment, where if you think about it, it's kind of funny, because if one's saying, no, there isn't a dispute of, you know, material fact, and then one's saying yes, and then they both are cross-petitioning, but it happens all the time. Generally, what happens in those situations is where they both see that they think their person should be believed more. I found it often undermine their petition, because they would be arguing against themselves in opposition to the cross petition. But normally it's the defendants are successful with this because it's just easier. So if we compare the summary judgment burden to the underlying trial burden, it's relatively similar. And then we're going to talk about evidentiary standards with respect to trial burden when we get to Anderson's Liberty Lobby in just a second. But that's kind of what we're looking at. All right. Let's kind of refine our standard under 56A, that first part, no genuine dispute of material fact, and the moving party's entitled to judgment as a matter of law, by looking at the Liberty Lobby case, and that was excerpted in your casebook. Liberty Lobby was a libel action. Have any of you guys studied libel yet? Yes? Libel? Some hands or no? I see some heads yes, and some people frozen, like, please don't call me. I'm not going to call on you about it. It just gives me a general sense of whether you understand it. All right, so Liberty Lobby is about defamation, and it was a published story basically claiming this individual is a fascist. All right, and it was the person who was the publisher of a magazine and his company, his organization, Liberty Lobby, or his company, Anderson's company, suing Liberty Lobby, which was the magazine, claiming libel. And in this case, the Supreme Court had actually rendered a ruling about the standard by which someone would have to show whether or not they have proved a claim for libel. And so let's talk about the summary judgment standard and talk about the issues that you're going to see in Liberty Lobby. Liberty Lobby should be in your notes for three separate reasons. The first is that it's going to tell us what burden of proof applies at the summary judgment phase, and what we mean is trial burdens of proof, preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt. What does the jury would have to be under that in the trial phase, what would the judge have to be under the summary judgment phase? Are they free to look at it without the confines of the trial burden, or must they look at it through the same prism? The second is the definitions of the first part of the standard. What's a genuine dispute? Realize Anderson was written in the old language, so it says issue, but it's the same analysis. And what is a material fact? So those three reasons are what we're going to get out of Liberty Lobby. All right, so Liberty Lobby, I told you a little bit that they're doing libel claims. The Supreme Court, in our New York Times case, gave us our elements. They told us something a little bit about them. What aspect did they tell us we needed to prove now? Sam, what aspect did they tell us we need to prove for a libel claim?
They need to prove actual malice.
Okay, and do you know what that means?
Malice?
Yeah, what does actual malice mean? Yeah, the casebook author thing kind of like mutilates it a little bit here because they're trying to just get down to the basic skinny part of what you need. But that's what changed. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that they knew the same for false or reckless.
Or with reckless with regard to its falsity. Yeah. So it's about the level of intention you have when you make a false statement. So those of you who haven't learned libel yet, what you're looking at, since it's libel, not just plain vanilla defamation, you actually have to have a publication of some kind. And so the newspaper report fits that. It has to be defamatory. In other words, it has to impugn your reputation. And it has to be false, because we can say bad things about your reputation, but if they're true, it's not slander, right? All right. The aspect, though, that New York Times added is when you are suing someone who's a public figure, or that's the person who's bringing the suit, the statement's about a public figure, that person can only prevail if they can show that the defendant, when they made the statement, acted with actual malice, that they knew the statement to be false, or they were reckless with regard to its truth or falsehood. And just so you know, that's so we can allow more liberty with speech about public figures because it's more part of our public discourse. So there's less libel claims. Because realize if you can bring a libel claim, you sting and kind of chill speech. And so the Supreme Court says that's what we have to have. They also give us the standard of, or the burden of proof on the actual malice. And what was that? What level of proof did you have to show actual malice?
Clear and convincing.
Okay, and what's the normal civil burden?
Preponderance.
Yeah, preponderance of evidence. And so you see that in most of your classes, preponderance of evidence kind of translates to what? Do you remember? Yeah, more likely than not. That if it's at a coin toss, we have to rule in favor of the person not carrying their burden. But if it's anything more than that, which is why sometimes we translate it for all of our math people into 51%, but it just means it's more than just a guess. More likely than not. Clear and convincing, what's that?
It's evidence that the thing proved is highly probable and
reasonably
certain.
Okay, highly probable, reasonably certain, somewhere between there and beyond a reasonable doubt. It's sort of it's really the highest level, clear and convincing is what you'll get in civil court, the highest level of burden of proof. Do you know why we have burdens of proof, what the purpose of those are?
Because certain matters sort of require them. For instance, it sort of depends on what the judgment could be. Maybe if you're going to jail, obviously you want to do it beyond reasonable doubt.
So and why? I mean, what purpose does the burden itself serve?
I guess the likelihood the outcome is correct.
Yeah, and it does that because it tells the person who has to make the decision how certain they have to be, how taxing they have to put the facts to. You know, how much do you really need to look at those facts with scrutiny? If we want to be more certain, we say your bar is a little higher. Your scrutiny should be a little tighter, a little bit more refined. You must do more before you reach this decision. All right, so who are we really talking to when we have a burden of proof? Who in our litigation? Who does that?
Who carries that burden?
Mm-hmm. Well, not who carries the burden, but who has to look at the facts and say, now I've got a stricter view. No, not generally the judge, actually. Who normally has to say, is this beyond a reasonable doubt?
Sure.
That's right. So we're in the domain of the jury. So understand that that's what we're talking about in Liberty Lobby. The jury, if it was to go to court, would have to use a tighter view than just your general civil view. More likely than not, I'm not flipping a coin, but I think it's more this than that. More than just a guess is preponderance of the evidence. Clear and convincing says, make sure you get it more refined. Hold them to a little bit higher of a standard when you're deciding whether or not the light was red or green, when you're deciding whether or not they actually knew the statement was false. So we're speaking to the jury there. Summary judgment, however, is the jury around? No, it's the judge. And so Liberty Lobby, the United States Supreme Court, is saying, what does the judge sitting in summary judgment have to do? All right. So what do they tell us here? What was the burden of proof that they have to use in the summary judgment phase? The judge. Yeah, so to make this a rule for all cases, a judge in summary judgment should use the burden of proof when examining whether there's a genuine issue material fact that we would find at where? You know, to make it more than just this case, but all cases, when a judge sits in summary judgment and decides whether or not to grant it, what kind of burden should they use? Burden of proof. Here it was clear and convincing. Sometimes it'll be preponderance of the evidence. They choose it because it's the one that we find where?
Just by the basic showing
of facts. Okay, it's my question that's faulty. I'm trying to figure out a good way to ask this. Like, so what you're giving me is like an applied rule, and all I want is more of a general rule that I can apply in any case. So right here you're saying the burden of proof is clear and convincing, which is true in this case. So can you give me a rule that's not just this case from Liberty Lobby?
Like in a negligence case.
What would the rule for summary judgment motions be? So if I want to say, you district judge, I work for you, and he asks me, what burden of proof should I use in my summary judgment motion ruling? I say you use which one? In negligence, but then again, it's applied. I want like more of a general rule for any case. He just says, well, I've got any case. I want to know which one I should apply. Yes.
Whatever burden would be used at trial.
Yeah. It's whatever burden would be used at trial. Just only because the way I asked it to you, we'd just gone down the wrong path. It was my question, not you. So I wanted just a general rule, and that's what it is. The standard is the one that you would see at trial. And that makes sense, because what we're doing is taking this away from the jury. So if the jury couldn't have rendered that decision because they would have had a higher burden of proof, then the judge shouldn't be able to do it, right? You shouldn't be able to go to the judge and say, well, look at it under less exacting of a standard. I think we'd win. No, the judge has to look at it under the same standard that the jury would have looked at. All right, so the rule ends up being you apply the same standard you find at trial. So free of clear and convincing, free of preponderance, fear of whatever it is, it's the standard used at trial. And here, it just happened to be clear and convincing. All right, which is sort of our policy question. Why would you do that? So it's the same. So we're not supplanting the jury's role. We're just saying, you're not needed. We're not taking your role away. We're just saying, in this case, we don't need you to come. Okay? All right. Any questions on the burden of proof? Which one you use? How would you figure out? You'd have to do substantive research to figure out what the trial burden is. But then the issue about summary judgment is done. It's just use the same one. One thing you want to do if you're opposing a summary judgment motion and you have a higher standard than preponderance of evidence, if you have a clear and convincing, it's a good time to make an argument to remind the judge that under the defendant's arguments, maybe what they're really arguing would be true under a preponderance standard, but not really true under clear and convincing. It gives you some room to oppose those motions. It's much harder to win. Much harder to win. Okay. So that was the first issue. The second parts we're going to see in Liberty Lobby is what does genuine dispute mean and what does material fact mean? We're going to take the latter first and look at material fact. Here's our hypotheticals from the worksheet. Okay. Which one of these is not a material fact? So you have it right on your worksheet. I'll move this down for a second. Is it A, the defendant reporter's affidavit testifies, he took written notes on Monday and then typed up the story on Tuesday. Plaintiff's witness says the story was complete on Monday. B, defendant reporter's affidavit says he never doubted the truth of the story, but the witness will testify reporter told her. I panic. Is it just not in the worksheet? There's people talking. Yeah? No? Okay. Okay, good, because I couldn't sense. I noticed people were kind of moving around. All right, if there's something else, let me know. B, the reporter's affidavit says he never doubted the truth of the story, but plaintiff's witness will testify the reporter told her, I don't believe a word of the story, but it's going to sell, sell, sell. Or is it C, defendant reporter's affidavit says that he believed that the plaintiff was a fascist because witness X reporter told plaintiff was a fascist, and the witness X denies she made such a statement. So which one of those would not be a material fact? Go ahead, figure this one out. What one would not be a material fact? Not be material. Which one would not be material? Okay, if you haven't already, I'm going to give you 20 seconds here. Go ahead and click on in just so we have as complete of data as we can. Okay, good. This one is A. So can someone explain why A is not material, and then maybe we can find a definition together of that? Why is A not material? You're right. Why is A not material? Yeah?
It doesn't align with one of the elements.
Okay, good. It doesn't align with one of the elements. Do we have to resolve this dispute to win anything? Is it needed to resolve any of the issues in the case? No. So materiality really talks about whether it's needed in order to resolve the disputes before us. And if the dispute is your claim, the question is it needed for one of your elements? If the dispute is about a defense, then the question is it about the thing you'd have to prove to show you satisfy the defense, whether it's statutory or common law? So you still look to the substantive law and say, what would a person have to prove to get there? Is this needed to get there? Okay, and it's dependent on the factual situation, so you kind of have to look to how they're stylizing their claim. Like a negligence claim is not the same as every other negligence claim. If they're stylizing their claim based upon whether or not reckless swerved, then those things that are, you know, with respect to that dispute will become the material aspect. Other things will not be. This is where you get a lot of dispute in your papers on summary judgment. It's talking about whether or not a dispute that you've identified is actually needed. And so people will try and recharacterize a claim to suggest that this is something that is needed to be resolved, and especially if there's a dispute about it, so we can avoid summary judgment. That's kind of how you do it. You try and say, we do need to get to this issue. It is disputed, and so therefore you shouldn't give summary judgment. For the person wanting summary judgment, you argue that the material ones have been resolved. The ones that are needed are resolved. These other things they're arguing about are not material. They're not needed. All right, we're going to see it in the context of reckless in a second. Let's just finish what the standard is. If we look at genuine dispute, the court gives us some good language. It tells us when determining if a genuine factual issue as to actual malice exists, a trial judge must bear in mind the actual quantum and quality of proof. The quantum and quality of proof. For example, there's no genuine issue if the evidence in the opposing affidavits is of insufficient caliber or quantity to allow a rational finder of fact to find actual malice by clear and convincing evidence. So material was, do we need to resolve it? Now we have to ask ourselves, do we really have a genuine dispute about these facts? And so we look to the quantum and quality of the proof. What do we mean by quantum and quality? Well, the mere existence of some evidence, I can say, hey, I've got something, be enough? Would that be enough? What do you think? The existence of just some evidence, is that going to be enough? Mr. Brokesh? Okay. Why not? That's right, by the way. You mean clear and convincing? So potentially, we might need it from a lot of areas. And that, I think, is what part of the statement, needing a lot of it, meaning numerous, what part of our statement would refer to that? Did you see that in there, anything about the number or the amount you have of evidence? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the other part is quality. So is there a situation that you can imagine where you might have, like, one piece of evidence, one witness? But they might be saying something that's of such quality, or that piece of evidence has such quality, that it might refute the argument against it, no more dispute. Could you imagine a smoking gun? Might it exist? Yeah. In some cases, we might not have a lot in number, but the quality is so good. Okay, let's say in a reckless case, I didn't give you this as a hypo, but let's just talk about it. Let's assume at the intersection that we're at, or the street we're at, there's several different vendors. It's New York City, everyone's got a camera everywhere. We probably caught this accident 50 ways to Sunday, right? Right, and on the still frame, every single time, we see Parsons, like, kind of fixing her earbuds, recklessly just skating right into him. Every single view. At some point, that kind of, that videotape might be of such quality that even if witnesses on the street have a different story, it's such that a reasonable fact finder couldn't, by our standard of proof, determine it any other way. Is there a way to refute something like videotape? Or is it just like, well, they got a videotape, might as well pack up shop and I'm out the door. Sorry. Yeah.
Sure, the videotape been edited.
Videotape maybe was edited. What else? It's okay. It's completely wrong. It was her just skating crazily on a different day, right? Maybe the view's not exactly accurate. Maybe it's fuzzy. Maybe there's something else that you couldn't see in the video that the witnesses can provide clarification for. You have a harder road to hoe when someone comes in with still frames of the accident. But it doesn't mean it's the end of the story. The question for the court here is, it's one of judgment. Is the evidence of sufficient number and quality that a reasonable finder of fact could find this way and really no other way? If there's a dispute amongst reasonable minds, do we have a genuine dispute? If there's a dispute amongst reasonable minds, do we have a genuine dispute? Yes, that's actually what it is. So it's like when reasonable minds disagree, then we have a genuine dispute. If we're talking about, do we have a need for the jury, I presume, are reasonable people. Could they potentially disagree and come to a different conclusion? So it's not you as the judge, do you think this is the reasonable outcome? It's, could reasonable people disagree in any way? If it is, then we should give it to those people, because it's not your job, judge, to make the determination. It's, I just decide that nobody could conclude and be reasonable any other way. Nobody could conclude and be reasonable any other way than this way. And that means we don't have a dispute. It is this. Nobody could find any other way than this. And this is material. All right? Does that make sense? There's no genuine dispute as to any of those material facts. We've resolved them all, and I'm entitled to law. The judgment is a matter of law. All right. If there is a genuine dispute, you need the jury. So that suggests no summary judgment for you. Here's a hypothetical based on Anderson, and then we're going to go to Parsons. All right. Which one of these is not a genuine dispute of material fact? Which one of these is not a genuine dispute of material fact? A, the defendant reporter's affidavit says that he believed that the plaintiff was a fascist because a key witness told plaintiff was a fascist. The witness denies she made such a statement. Defendant reporter's affidavit says he believed that the plaintiff was a fascist because a key witness who told him he was a fascist in front of 100 people. The witness denies that she made such a statement, but all 100 people file affidavits agreeing with the reporter. Which one shows no genuine issue of, or no genuine dispute of fact? No genuine dispute of fact. Which one is not a genuine dispute of fact? Which one is not a genuine dispute of fact? Meaning, which one could give a summary judgment, right? You know, like, or at least which one is not a genuine dispute of fact? Which one is not a genuine dispute of fact? Not a genuine dispute of fact. Okay, go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Thank you. All right, great. You guys are doing great. This is actually... tends to be harder than you think for people, but you're just doing excellent, so very good for you. The second one is no dispute of fact. Why? Because now we have such a quantum and quality of evidence that the witness who denies it probably can't be believed by any reasonable decision maker. The problem is this case the one that's going to go to summary judgment? No. If you really start doing discovery and you find that he says, oh, yeah, I thought this wasn't a false statement because she told me that he's a fascist, and she said it at a dinner party in front of all these people on the microphone. You start interviewing these people, deposing them, and you find out that all in fact, that, yep, that's exactly what happened. Got up, said it on the microphone, and I'm willing to submit an affidavit in favor of it. You settle your case, right? Basically, sometimes you're just going to have to discharge your claim because you just don't have one. All right, but this is to show you when you would have, in a very clear case, no dispute of fact. Why is A a dispute? Because could a reasonable person believe the witness? Yeah. Could a reasonable person believe the reporter? Yeah. And so who should decide this? The jury. It should not be rendered on summary judgment. Let's make it a little trickier, and I want you to work at this together. So let's assume we're in our case. I'll move this down. Okay. The right side of the room, I want you to come up with, in our case, any, in your mind, what you think might be a material fact. So something that's needed to be decided to get to the judgment. Just any material fact. You guys come up with not a material fact. Fine, maybe something we might be disputing about, but it's not material to our case. Then we're going to talk about how we can make it a genuine dispute versus a non-genuine dispute. So you guys just give me the random sample of what you think is material facts and is potentially an issue in our suit, immaterial facts that we might come across. Okay? Go ahead. It's your own hypo time. We'll use one of yours and make it our second part. Don't go to genuine yet. We're going to use one of ones in the class. Just do material. Find something that's material. Find, make up an immaterial fact. It's more fun. You can do it with any aspect. Remember, materiality doesn't just have to do with greed. Anything. It doesn't have to. Okay. Reckless is moving for summary judgment. judgment on you. You want to identify material facts.
No, don't judge material facts. There is about what you would want to do. Don't be material facts. Don't point to this one. Decide on your fact. Okay, so why are we doing the exercise? Two things. First of all, it'll help you in the most immediate future issue spot on an exam if I ask you a question about things. But second of all, it's basically what you do whenever you're going through litigation is identifying, as you're seeing things come out of discovery that might be disputed, what likely the other side is going to move for summary judgment on, how you're going to deal with that, and things you want to avoid. Like you don't want to, you know, you're trying to get on summary judgment motion, but you point to something in material. So let's start out with our material facts first. What kind of material facts might be at issue in our suit? Reckless says, I entitled summary judgment. You say, oh, there's this material issue at dispute. Yes. Okay. The question of the heart attack when it occurs. Okay. What other material facts might there be? What other material facts?
Yeah. If he had been drinking that morning.
Okay. If he was intoxicated. Any other material facts?
If Reckless had to actually swerve off across the road to hit Parkinson's.
Okay. Whether he changed unlawfully changed lanes. Okay. Any other material facts? Because these are all material facts as to what piece of our claim right now. Because remember, it goes to the substance of your claim. What are these material facts about? What part of the claim are we talking about right now? Yeah, what part of the negligence claim? Little negligence? So breach, is that what you mean? Like little negligence? Yeah. So, yeah, it's the breach element right now. Okay? We didn't have any other ones, but could we have a material fact that's about damage?
Sure.
What would our material fact be about damage? The value of the violin, whether it was damaged previously or not, or damaged by this incident or not, whether or not she actually suffered the injury she maintained she suffered. So we have one about cause. Yeah. You know, whether or not this was the actual cause or another driver. Okay, so we pointed to a couple ones. We'll let the class vote on which one they want to talk about. Let's find some fun immaterial facts. What would be immaterial for our dispute? Yeah. Yeah, what kind of rollerblades she was wearing. Okay. How might that become material? Now, I'm actually going to post a practice problem for you to review your joinder rules. That we see a joinder in the future of who potentially might come into our suit. The rollerblader manufacturer. Who might want to bring them in? Maybe Parsons. She might want to join them as a Rule 20 joinder of a defendant, right? Who else might want to bring them in? Reckless. Why might Reckless want to bring them in? They were defective, and they were really the cause of the injury, so they're now a... You're with me here, buddy. Yeah, I'm a tortfeasor. And we're now joint tortfeasors, right? And so what's our joint rule for those people when the defendant wants to join a joint tortfeasor? In some jurisdictions, we allow it if... Yeah, they've got joint several liability because they is, or maybe, liable to me, Reckless, for all or part of Parsons' claim against me. So now they come in. Now is it material?
Heck yeah,
because if it isn't those rollerblades, it's now the aqua-slide case. Remember, we sue the wrong people. All right, so that's how it comes up. Very good. Very, very good. All right, what other immaterial facts? But you're right. Right now, totally immaterial. Totally immaterial. What other immaterial facts do we have? Can you create a license and no one wants to use it? Yeah. Where she was rollerblading to, like her ultimate destination. Right. Because the directionality at that moment is important. Their ultimate destination might not. Could we make it important? She's rollerblading fast to the emergency room. Right. Now it might be more material because it might be some way, some information about how she was rollerblading sporadically, easily, you know. Typically, that would definitely not. Good. What else? Immaterial. And it's just as important to point out the immaterial facts as it is the immaterial facts.
I think if people are misled, thinking that they just focus on what's material to them, but you have to be able to identify what the other side is saying is immaterial just as much as you have to be able to identify your own material facts.
What he had for breakfast that morning, unless it was obviously...
Unless it was narcotics.
Bloody Mary.
Right? Unless it was narcotics, in which case it is very material. See how we can kind of change almost any fact and make it material. When I worked at the Eastern District of Michigan, the judge I worked for had an interesting painting on the side of the wall, and it relates to summary judgment. I'm not just talking about painting. And it was the... it was weird. It was a surgical rendering of a knee. And there was an artery behind the knee. There's a point to it. I finally got the courage, like, judge, what is this, you know? And it had labeled on the side the artery of Fuzes. What? So the story is he had actually been in the middle of World War II, was in medical school before he decided to go to law school and become a very, very famous judge now. And at the time, they didn't have, like, any kind of, like, real photographers. It was artists that would go in and try and capture what you would see if you had done resections of cadavers so that you'd know in surgery later what you're looking for. And he said, there's this tiny, tiny little blood vessel that feeds the kneecap area right behind the kneecap. And you have to be very precise when you go in to look at it. He goes, I don't remember what it's called, but I call it artery acoustics because it doesn't matter. The point of my story. To know my judge, you know kind of why that's sort of funny. But anyway, he's like, he goes, Angela, it's all about the artery acoustics. Okay, sure. What do you mean? He said, that's summary judgment. I said, what? He said, here there's all this other stuff. It looks important. It's veins, it's tubular, it's muscle, it's tendon, it's tissue, and I'm going to get all messed up all in the middle of all the rest of it. It all comes down to the physics. Because if you don't know what's material and immaterial, your opponent is going to make the case look obscure and get past summary judgment. Because for a good defense lawyer, the most important task that they have is getting through the mass of all the chaos and saying, this is the only thing that's important. And so that, I thought, was a really good lesson for what it is. So this tactic today is to try and get you to look and work on exercising that skill. I think most students perceive that what you're going to see is that when you get under practice, that material stuff is just going to jump out of you. I know the law. I know it's material. And that's not the case. Because discovery isn't linear. It's much like studying for this course. You're kind of all in a mess. You're trying to figure stuff out. Witnesses will talk about what they know. They're not going to talk about in the order of the elements. They don't come up to you and say, well, I'm the duty witness. She's the breach witness. You might want to talk to me first, right? And so it's a very big mess when you first get out of practice. And if you're more attuned to what you're looking for, you become better. And it's also easy to get confused because the other side, their whole goal is to throw other issues in there and show whether material or not. All right, so let's get to genuine. Let's pick one of our material facts and make it genuine and not genuine. Make a dispute about it. Any one of those? Let's pick the swerving lanes, whether or not he swerved to hit her. What would be a genuine dispute? How might we make that genuine? Anybody? How would we make that genuine? Do you need to talk to Parker? Take for a second. Talk to Parker. How would you make it genuine? How would you make it not genuine? That's our fact. Whether he swerved. Okay, how do we make it a genuine dispute about swerving? Anybody?
Something that's been talking a while. Anybody who hasn't volunteered yet?
Yes, thank you.
She said there's no other witnesses.
Okay, so it's Reckless and Parsons. Is that enough to overcome it if it's just your two competing affidavits?
Like
summary judgment, say now we have a genuine issue of dispute of material fact. You've already said this fact is material as to whether or not you can get judgment. Is that enough? Yes, it is. Can you stand on your own affidavit? Yes, you can. Just because it's yours doesn't mean that it's not something that you can believe, especially if it's a credibility issue. Now, if it's your affidavit against a bunch, like 100 other witnesses or unbiased, maybe now a reasonable jury couldn't conclude that your affidavit is actually valid. Just because it came from you is not. That's a good way to make a judgment. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we keep using the number 100, but what about if it was only 5?
It just depends. And we'll get to it in our hypotheticals, those next extra hypos that we're going to start our next class in. But it doesn't have to be that much. Just realize, if there's anything that a reasonable jury could say, I actually agree with those other people, then it goes to the jury. And so where's our inclination? To render summary judgment or not, where should our kind of thumb be on the balance scale of giving summary judgment or not? Should be against. That's right. But I'll tell you why it goes to your judicial philosophy. That's the next story. It goes to your judicial philosophy with both costs. All right, and that's actually one of the bigger ones you'll see when people are appointed by Democratic or Republican presidents. We tend to see more differences. Our more conservative judges tend to give summary judgment more quickly than our more liberal ones. There's a couple of empirical studies that are quite interesting, and it tends to be in labor involved. All right, we'll see you in next class. Look at those extra hypos. That's where we're going to start up. So the red-green lights, that's where we're starting.